We come to the 12th presentation of the 2012 major series. Its title, Hermetic Bodhisattvas, connotates that there was an enormous swath of human civilization that was affected exactly at the same time, so that one can characterize it as a threshold of energy in time in a vast amount of human space. We've been looking at how the major index of the wave in its initial appearance about 90 AD spread from Ireland to India. And this enormous swath had a three-prong quality. The middle prong, the pivot, the generator of the energy wave threshold was in Alexandria about 90 AD. And we have been trying to show that the preparation for this went back a little over 50 years before. In fact, we can date it. The generation of that wave in its initial carrier wave frequency was 36 AD. And following in an enormous sequence, you found that by 37 AD, the main thrust of it was to the west, reaching all the way to the west country of Britain, not England. This is before there was an England. But its focus was on the Irish Sea, so that all of the coasts of Ireland, southern Scotland, Wales, what became Somerset and Cornwall and the upper reaches of Devon, even out into Wiltshire, all of that terrain reverberated at the same time recursively back not only to Alexandria, but receiving a poignancy from Jerusalem. It also, at the very same time, swept into the Aegean, focusing on the great city of Ephesus. And just a few years later, about 4 years later, a follow-up to that western wave came and touched into northern Spain. At the same time, that particular wave went down the Gulf of Aqaba, down the Red Sea, deposited half of its energy in Ethiopia, and the other half went across the Arabian Sea, the part of the Indian Ocean, to southern India. All of this happened between 36 and 41 AD in those 5 years. So that the energy compression was enormous, and by 41 AD, you had, from Ireland to India, a resonance set that had a harmonic, and the harmonic was focused on a shared presence pair, and that shared presence pair is the historical Jesus in Alexandria and Mary Magdalene. And it is difficult to understand until one comes to a beholding vision how all of this could have been affected seemingly without a plan, but with some kind of a very high strategy. We need to pay attention here.
We're told there's no audio.
It's fine. we're going to continue here. All right? This is a yoga. It's not a planned delivery. We're in a yoga, and we're going to keep that here. We're talking about harmonic. A harmonic does not need a plan. A plan is a mental structure. A harmonic is a spiritual reaching out on a cosmic level to eternity. So that there is a quality that we're understanding and realizing here in the 2012 series, that there is a preparation which we're calling a reference wave that about 350 years later has a carrier wave, but that it transpires not as an event, but as an opening of a cascade in space-time, so that it unfolds historically. And what it unfolds is the understanding of the vision in larger and larger increments until it feels like it has filled the entire, not universe, but a transformed universe into a cosmology, which one can then recognize that the fulcrum of that particular ecology between the theory and the cosmology were special persons that were tuned in the reference wave, super special persons that were tuned in the carrier wave, and around both were clusters of very special men and women who acted, and the phrase is, as pilot waves, as guides, to make sure that the referencing was not limited to some kind of identification, and that the carrying was not limited to some kind of identity. The pilot wave was first introduced in 1927 at the Salve conference in Belgium, in Brussels, founded by a very wealthy industrialist. And the fifth Salve conference was a who's who in mathematics and physics at the time. One of the stars of that particular show was, of course, Albert Einstein, and his photo is in the upper right. And in the lower left is Niels Bohr. And then you have Werner Heisenberg with his uncertainty theory, and you have Erwin Schrödinger with his wave theory. But in the center here, as a pivot, are two geniuses, one of them Max Born, who was like the teacher of a great many of the young upcoming people like Wolfgang Pauli and many others. But the central figure for us is the man in the center here. His name is Louis de Broglie, and he was a French prince. He was Prince de Broglie. He had a brother, Maurice. He took Einstein seriously when Einstein said that the carrier of electromagnetic energy was a particle called a photon. We today in the 21st century have many companies around the world that specialize in photonics. But then it was extremely rare, except that it took a pilot wave genius like Prince de Broglie to understand that Einstein was saying that the particle of light is encased in the wave of light, in such a way that the particle does not have an identity of its own outside of the context of the wave. And that because there is a kind of a supra-phenomenal relationship between the photon and the light wave, that every particle then in the universe, in terms of atomics, or what soon would be subatomics, because the photon is not an atom, the electron is not an atom, so that every sub-particle of every particle has a wave that carries it, and that one can become eventually refined enough to be able to understand then that because the particle does not have an extraneous, separate identity, its identification is obviously then an error. And that identifying and basing one's understanding on just identification is misleading and, in fact, is illusional. And to believe it is delusional. It was very difficult to find. The first time that de Broglie put this together was, in fact, a few years before the Solvay 1927 conference. It was in September of 1923. This book, published by Cambridge University Press on the conference, that was just released a couple of years ago, has a couple of sentences. It was released in 2009. In September 1923, Prince Louis de Broglie made one of the most astonishing predictions in the history of theoretical physics, that material bodies would exhibit wave-like phenomena of diffraction and interference upon passing through sufficiently narrow slits, like Einstein's prediction of the deflection of light by the sun, which was based on a reinterpretation of gravitational force in terms of geometry. De Broglie's prediction of the deflection of electron paths by narrow slits was made on the basis of a fundamental reappraisal of the nature of force and of dynamics. De Broglie proposed Newton's first law of motion be abandoned and replaced by a new postulate, according to which a freely moving body follows a trajectory that is orthogonal to the surfaces of equal phase of an associated guiding wave. Which means when there are pilot wave persons, men and women, who are able to come into an orthogonal guiding wave of equal phase, they are able to guide the way in which the universe works. This is the whole basis of what a bodhisattva is. What a bodhisattva not is, but what a bodhisattva is doing. The difference is best appreciated and understanding two words from Sanskrit. The old Sanskrit word, pada, means path, like an early collection of the sayings of the Buddha, the Dhamma pada. Dhamma is the southern pronunciation of Dharma. In Ceylon, they speak with a southern accent. The Dharma pada, the Dharma path. But there is a way of placing it into that one stands in on the path. And the pair of feet is the earliest presentation of the Buddha, that one is on the path. And we even today have teachers all over the world talking about getting you on the path. In refined Sanskrit, the term that becomes preferred is marga. When the Gandhi centenary in 1969 was being held around the world, I was the American representative from Berkeley, California, to the Gandhi Peace Foundation for the centennial, and their publication was called Gandhi Marg, meaning that the publication, their magazine, was a part of the Marga, different from the path in a refined way. A path is something you follow. A Marga is what you are doing. And it has a resonant set way of reaching a harmonic so that someone who is not just on the path, but who is walking the Marga has a different quality. Their phases are tuned so that there is such a thing as not just the present moment on the path, there is, and there always is, being tuned together in, not on the walkway, but in the walking. One of the great exemplars of the difference was in 1930, about the time that all of these physics, all of this mathematics was coming to the fore. One of the great spiritual transformations happened in India, and that was that the British Empire had come to a point of absurdity in trying to exercise their empire control over India. They put a tax on salt. Now, in a hot country like India, salt is part of the way in which you stay healthy. If you think that the Tea Party has some kind of a deep basis because there was a tax on tea, think again. To put a tax on salt is like putting a tax on breathing. So Gandhi made a famous salt march from in his home Gujarat state at Dandi to Dandi on the sea. And he went from his Sabarmati ashram and he walked the long distance, joined finally by tens of thousands of people. The American reporter, his last name actually was Walker. And when the film Gandhi was made, the director brought out the humor of the whole thing. Gandhi laughing, "My name is Walker, yes," and with his staff, and went to the sea and dipped his hands into the sea and put it where it could evaporate and left sea salt. And within a day, there were millions. And within a couple of days, there were tens of millions. And within a week, there were hundreds of millions of people making their own salt in India. To make the point, you cannot plan an empire when there is a guiding pilot wave bodhisattva who shows what is limpidly real. It's not about understanding something complex. It's about doing the real. And when the real is done, it's really done. Because it cues in other pilot waves to help with that guiding. And when there's a community, and by now in the 21st century, it is a huge community of men and women who have that harmonic of being guiding waves, not to push a present moment so that we can get further on the plan, but to participate in the presence, which evens out the phases so that there's no longer a past and a future, but that they are a part of a continuity that is guided, piloted by shared presence. One of the most beautiful books recently is by Karen C. Lang, published by Oxford in 2003. It's called Four Illusions. The subtitle is Chandra Kirti's Advice for Travelers on the Bodhisattva Path. Refined would be on the Bodhisattva Way, the Marga. A path, and then the Marga, the doing of it, is a way. So that, for instance, the word Mahayana means great way. And originally, what was taught in Alexandria was the way. It wasn't about an ism or an inanity. It's just the great way. By the way, the name of the person, Chandra Kirti, in Sanskrit, Chandra is moon, and Kirti is famous. So scholarly works are called, call him Famous Moon, one of the great selections and collections of one of Chandra Kirti's most eloquent, famous books. It was called Entering the Middle Way. Not being on the middle path, but entering the middle way, which means participating. The book is actually on the great commentary of Chandrakirti. He lived in the 500s. He lived in the 6th century AD. He was the head of the one of the greatest universities that the world has ever seen, Nalanda in northeast India. Nalanda Mahayana University was so huge, it had buildings 40 stories high. And Chandrakirti, I prefer, instead of saying famous moon, to put it in the refined sense, that he was the moon famous, head of Nalanda. And the great commentary was by the 8th Karmapa, Mikyo Dorji. And it's interesting because Mikyo Dorji has an institute in the 21st century in London, and it's headed by my old Dharma friend, Karma Tinley Rinpoche. This is a portrait of Karma Tinley. When I brought him from Toronto to Los Angeles in 1976 to deliver a series of 3 10-day presentations making a 3-part resonant set. One was on the Tibetan Buddhism, because very few people really understand Tibetan Buddhism. They look to Tibetans to give them from their planned hierarchy of the Gelugpa sect especially, and sometimes of the Kagyu sect, sometimes even of other more esoteric sects like the Nyingma. But the first series early in the day was on Tibetan Buddhism. The afternoon was a series at the same 10 days on Tibetan language. And then in the evening, the third series was on the history of the Karmapas. At that time, there were 16 Karmapas. And it's interesting to see that the 8th Karmapa, Mikyo Dorji, was the pivot of the 16 Karmapa harmonic set. So that when the Gyalwa Karmapa, the 16th, passed on, his reincarnation was of such an accumulated energy that the 17th karmapa came out as a pair. And the preference has been to identify, even in the Vajrayana, there are periods where identity and identification subtly and subtly leach in. So that one of the karmapas is famous as being the 17th karmapa, but the other 17th karmapa is the 17th karmapa as well. Because when there's that kind of a narrow slit that the Gyalwa karmapa provided, the energy wave of reincarnation did exactly what electrons will do. It produces a pair. The pair is actually a pair of pairs, and it works this way. An electron, any electron, is paired already with its absence, with its whole, so that in late 20th, early 21st century manufacturing, we can use electron holes as part of the manufacturing of things. But because the electron splits by the slit, there are two electrons in their holes. So it's a quartet. The first electron will be that of space-time, that registry where the emphasis is on the space that most people would use as the founding of their identification. The present moment in this space. But the other is equally real and is paired with it, is tuned with it, not in space-time, but in time-space. So that the emphasis then is on the time, not on the space. So that you have an interesting reality that particles, photons, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., not only have pairedness on the deepest level, if you use one or the other exclusively as the registry for identification, it will always be uncertain. And its uncertainty will slide off like a slippery eel because the observer is also a conscious dimension, which is a part of the lifting of the universe out of its space-time, time-space, into a higher order. Not only that, but something like, for instance, the particle of an electron, even with its electron-hole pair and its pair of electron-holes pairs, there is a higher energy electron called a muon. And not only that, there's a very much higher energy of the electron muon called the tau particle, found outside of Chicago in 1983. Leon Letterman and his group had worked on it for years. They had discovered the W particles, and they found the tau particle in 1983. This is at the Fermi Lab, which is way out in the west of Chicagoland, right on the very edge of the cornfield prairie. So that in order to write this in a real mathematic, the way that it's written is a pair cubed and doubled. The 2 to the third power, which makes an 8, with its double, which makes a 16. And you will find, not only universally, but cosmically, that 16 is an enormously revelatory quality of not identification, but of understanding. For instance, one of the greatest refined meditators, not only on this planet and this star system, but any star system, was our historical Buddha. He was able to refine so that he could behold a moment of thought. In Sanskrit, it's called a citta. And when that citta is raised to very high energy, it becomes a bodhicitta, a moment of enlightenment. But a moment of thought only resolves into 8 discursive, quote, parts. The other 8 parts never are discursive. They always occur, and the best word is from music, they always occur as a trill. And they don't occur as a trill, they occur trilling in such a way that they make the space of discursiveness in between the other 8 particles. They're the spaces between the fingers. So that a moment of thought is a 50-50 reality. It is in space-time, time-space. It also is outside of space-time, time-space, which in Sanskrit, the word shunyata expresses that. They first refined prismatic pilot wave to be able to understand that was named Nagarjuna. Naga means a snake, especially like a king snake. And Arjuna from the Bhagavad Gita, who lived in South India, he lived originally in the area that is now, it used to be the great city of Madras, now it's called Chennai. It's in Tamil Nadu, Tamil state. And on one side of Tamil Nadu is Sri Lanka, across Adams Bridge in the Bay of Bengal, Indian Ocean. And on the northern part is Andhra province. And the really strong river in Andhra province is the Krishna River. Nagarjuna was one of the strongest pilot waves. In fact, he is called in the Mahayana the second Buddha. He lived 100 years. He lived from about 150 to about 250 AD. Occasionally there are pilot waves, like Pythagoras lived to be 99, who are there for a long lifetime to make sure that the guiding of this in a major way is a recalibration. A recalibration from the inert, innate tendency to reduce things back to identity, and an identity which can identify quicker, faster, better than anyone else, therefore we should take over. And this is the challenge of not ignorance, but its raising, or rather lowering, its energy into stupidity. And there are empires of stupidity competing on this planet currently, which resemble a squabble of the kindergarten during recess, during a fight, because someone stole the ball. This must be recalibrated, because it does not go on, it ends. We do not need that kind of tragedy. We have had tragedies enough. In fact, one of the origins of the great carrier wave of 0 BC was its reference wave of about 350 BC, and that reference wave was characterized by the passing of one of the great reference wave persons and the birth and coming into an early maturity of the other. The old one passing away was Plato, and the young one coming in was the young Alexander the Great. And they were mediated by Plato's greatest student and the tutor of Alexander the Great by Aristotle. When we come back from the break, we're going to see an exemplar of how a reference wave in terms of its classical Greek heritage is one of the easiest ways in civilized history to understand that there is a context of a Renaissance that prepares for the reference wave to establish itself so that the carrier wave can benefit from the Renaissance as well as the reference wave, and that it is an energy frequency that comes back to its equal phase, equanimity, so that there is a portal of accessibility that is quite rare. And it's only there for a little while. And it's there especially for that generation who live at the carrier wave momentum as it registers in that first generation. Let's take a break. The quality of something like Gandhi's march to the sea to make salt at Dandi was generated by what he called satyagraha, which means graha is like our grasping, holding. Sat is like our sit, to sit at the feet of. It means to be able to hear truth. So satyagraha means truth holding. And you don't hold truth graspingly, you hold it with open hands. And that open-handedness is able to be shared and passed on. The refinement of it came a couple of years after Gandhi had been assassinated. And Gandhi's prize student, like Aristotle was Plato's prize student, his prize student was, his name was Vinoba Bhave. And he came to Gandhi, and Gandhi, he looked at him. He was only about 19, 20 years old. He said, "You're a giant," in Sanskrit, bhima. He said, "I want you to prepare yourself to go to the very geographic center of India and to establish an ashram there." And so he did, and it was out in the desert. Rajasthan desert, but the central India desert, and he established Wardha. And then Gandhi was assassinated, and he was never called. And he didn't know what to do. And finally, in 1951, he realized that he could no longer just sit and be there refining. So he started walking and became known eventually as India's walking saint. He went into the marga in a refined, higher way than the path. And he just walked. And finally, he got into an area of South India where two brothers owned all the land. And they developed an animosity. And so this entire village area, regional area, was suffering. And so Vinoba sat down with the two of them. And after a long while of his pilot wave comprehensive yoga energy, they both broke down into tears, realizing that on this scale of the real, it's not only petty and ignorant, but it's further than stupid to do what they were doing. And so he turned to each of them and he said, I want both of you to adopt me as one of your sons. And I want you to give me my share of the inheritance now, which I will hold in trust. And I will let the people of the village and the region work my lands. And this became known as the land gift mission, the Bhudan Yajna. And he kept doing this in village after village. India has 700,000 villages. And eventually, that yajna produced the largest landholding trust in the world. For instance, one of the great states in India is Bihar, the home state of the Buddha. And two-thirds of Bihar is under this Bhudan Yajna trusteeship. And Vinoba said the refinement of satyagraha is sarvodaya. Sarvo means all, everybody. And daya is the trust, held in trust. So the sarvodaya movement is not reported in the press or mentioned by politicians because it dissolves their identification matrix. One of the last places Vinoba was walking in Pakistan because he said it extends beyond India. It extends out into the world. And one of his great inheritors after he passed away was a woman named Vimala Sarkar. And her books are little tiny books, like pamphlets. This one is called Beyond Awareness. Here's another one by Vimala, From Intellect to Intelligence. She now has passed on and passed it on to others. But you might look up Vimala Sarkar and Vinoba Bhave and understand that there are huge bodhisattvas in the world, men and women, who have been here diligent for quite some while, and that's why there is like a rising ebullience that undercuts the confidence that things are okay in the planned identification pseudo-realm. It's not that everything is getting worse, but that everything is being exposed as being unacceptable. It just is not right at all. Never will be. I talked about Karen Lane, who became the head of the Asian Studies Center at the University of Virginia. She replaced Jeffrey Hopkins after 12 years, who was the great translator for the Dalai Lama. And in her book on Chandrakirti, The Four Illusions, she writes just a few sentences here. The medium of the message often took the form of verses or short prose passages that could be easily memorized and passed on from one generation of disciples to the next. The aphoristic prose or verse of the original or root texts required oral and written commentaries to clarify. and elaborate ambiguous and overly concise wording, and to impose a structural unity on the text. An extensive commentarial literature developed around the debate between the various Buddhist and Brahmanical schools and so forth. These commentaries, modeled on traditional oral explanations of text, often paraphrase individual works and analyze the components of compounds and grammatical relations. But further from this, she points out, is the recognition that in the Mahayana, it's not about getting rid of all the Sanskrit word is klesas, it means impurities, to become pure enough to be a Buddha. That still roots you in a natural cycle that has a completion. The Sanskrit word for that completion is moksha. Moksha means that, as the Buddha said, whatever needs to be stood up has been stood up, whatever needs to be taken down has been taken down. That leaves you in a phase balance, which is the zero horizon out of which time itself comes spontaneously. And it's not that it's a zero point. What is a zero point? A locus without dimension, which means that it's a zero field. So that you have to mature and go into field physics, field theory. But there are complex fields. So that there is a quality that comes into play where you begin to realize that if you are going to mature, you can't stop at completion. It curves on into its pair, which is perfection. So that you can take the four seasons of a natural cycle, which renews, repeats, and you can transform it into four phases, which then go on to have a complementarity of four more phases of perfection, which gives you that eight. Which is interesting because one of the great discoveries out of Caltech in the late middle 20th century was Murray Gell-Mann's The Eightfold Way. He's the one that named quarks, understanding that there are up quarks, there are down quarks. They pair. But they do not occur individually. They always occur paired. So that a proton will have two one way and one the other. A neutron will have two the other way and one the other. We'll have three. But the Noble Eightfold Way, and there's a big selection of Murray Gell-Mann's selected papers published out of World Scientific in Singapore, one of the world's great esoteric high dharma publishers of science. It has a quality, because Gell-Mann's office was just down a couple of doors from Richard Feynman's office, and they would often have their little bickers and tussles and humor. But Gell-Mann went on from Caltech to go to establish the Santa Fe Institute, which studies, has studied for a long time, complexity. It is an interesting thing to begin to understand and to appreciate that what we are doing is we are here inquiring into a complexity that has a governing harmonic, not a structural harmonic so much, though it is that as well, but that it has a refining harmonic as well, and that the structural harmonic can come back to the zero field and the refining field can go forward to the infinite field. She says, if you realize that there's no individuality, that you have been reincarnated from before, you will reincarnate again, it means that you cannot take a present as a dividing of past and future. So my phrase, the future and the new past, uses the presencing, which we would say permeates the entire continuity of time, space, space-time. The Bodhisattva term translates as perfuming, because there is a flowering, and the flowering of it is that in the west the rose, in the east the lotus, has blossomed. One of the most interesting relationships is that between a great pilot wave passing on to another great pilot wave, so that one builds, if the yoga is held, it builds a tapas, so that it's not that the next great pilot wave is so much greater, it's that the pilot wave itself becomes of a higher energy, of a higher reach, higher time energy, farther space reach. 500 BC, as we have seen, was a renaissance. It was a renaissance of the renaissance of 2500 BC, whose most conspicuous thing are the Great Pyramids in Egypt. But there was also a cluster of pilot wave geniuses in the Renaissance of 500 BC, one of which was the historical Buddha in India, another was Lao Tzu of the Tao Te Ching in China, another was Pythagoras from the Greek-Egyptian. If you look to see that the reference wave of Plato and Alexander the Great in 350 BC, if one goes back 2,000 years before that, you come to 2350 BC. You come to Sargon of Akkad and his daughter Enheduanna. If you go a millennium back from them, you come to 3250 BC. And it's difficult to appreciate unless you're really civilized, not just educated, that that enormous swath from Ireland to India was active as a reference wave in 3250 BC. What was happening in India in 3200 plus BC was what became recorded as the Mahabharata. Later on, in its classic poetic by Vyasa, which is like the wind speaking. In Ireland, in the Boyne River Valley, you had the building finally of Newgrange, at the same time as the Mahabharata in India, the actual Mahabharata. And if you look at the fulcrum, of course there was no Alexandria yet, but there was an Egypt, and about that time the Egyptian gnomes, their provinces, their little states, clustered into a pair of kingdoms, a north and a south kingdom, which at 3000 BC became united as the first dynasty of India. And you begin to see that there are reverberations, not just of the vibrations, but of the resonant sets that begin to carry, if there are men and women as pilot waves who are able to tune them, not themselves so much, but their sharingness, they engender that great sine wave of a carrier wave that begins with its descent from the zero horizon into what will be its trough, and then it rises and at the millennium breaks through into that zero horizon again, and then the crest of it, which is the Renaissance, matches the trough, so that there's a symmetry to the way in which time, as the first dimension energy, characterizes that here is like a preparation. And just as 500 BC is a preparation for the zero BC carrier wave, our Renaissance at 500 years after the millennium, 1500 AD, prepared our carrier wave, which has just occurred a couple of decades ago, not even that, just barely. So that when we look to understand where we are, we're at a higher intensity of where that previous carrier wave was, about 11 AD. And that previous carrier wave had a tremendous boost in its ability to bring dimensionality of a very high order, an 11 dimension, high string theory order, into play. And two things happened in 14 AD concomitantly. Augustus Caesar died. He had more or less ruled the world for 44 years, established what we understand as a Roman Empire. He died. And Jesus in Alexandria became the president of the Therapeutai community at 23, witnessed by Philo in his treatise that still survives on the contemplative life. It's like a do-si-do. And that do-si-do is like the shift from what you can measure in terms of force and control and identity and identification, where the other that is not available for such identification, such control, such power, to come in to carry the denominator so that the pilot wave men and women, if they tune themselves sharingly to the new common denominator, they will become the numerators that are able to effectively be real. So we're understanding that we have, in this particular generation, for some decades yet, the ability to shift from a present power point to a shared presence pilot wave community. We have the carrier wave. We have the reference waves. We have a whole heritage of that, which it has accrued itself. One of the great previous carrier waves to zero BC was in 2000 BC. And its focus was again a tunable pair with a resolving third in the middle. The tunable pair was Abraham with his carrier wave vision of a new promised land, and Zarathustra with his ability to write the Gathas, which became a way to understand that there was a community of noble friends who were like the pilot waves. There was also the man of light, who is a carrier wave, who understands that by going into a promised land, one has the ability to stop a cycle of repetition and to initiate something that is refinably now new. Not displacing the old, but transforming it. Abraham's father, Terah, was a maker of little icons for the moon god. The family had done that for a long time in Ur, where Eni-Joanna was the high priestess. Abraham, in his vision, stopped making icons. He started presencing, so that when he was visited by higher dimensional beings, he invited them to sit under the shade of his tree and partake of the food. Those were the angels on their way to Sodom and Gomorrah to destroy it. And in the conversation, it's reported in Genesis, and you can read it. This is a translation of just six lines of Zarathustra's Gathas, by translation, from the very first yasna, which is one of the resonances of the Gathas. There are four Gathas. There are a series of 16 yasnas. They make a bodhicitta harmonic. Asha is the feminine wisdom order carrier. And Ahura is the Lord who helps human beings who are guided by six holy spirits. They were called Amesha Spenta in the ancient Avestic language. And they eventually, in the Mahayana, became the six paramitas. One of the words in here you will understand, even though it seems mispronounced, is mantra. In Avesta, and it's mantra. In Sanskrit, it's mantra, because Sanskrit is derived from Avestan. Just like later on, as Sanskrit is derived, when Abraham moves from where he was towards the Holy Land, he had to go by a caravan route from Haran that went down through ancient Ugarit, which was one of the ports that connected the early Proto-Phoenicians. But when he came, he brought a high North Semitic literacy from Eni-Joanna, which, because it was an inheritance of Sargon's vast trading caravan route swath of civilization that ran from Cyprus to the Indus River. And because they dealt with so many different languages and so many different people, they came up with prototypes then of the written language in the cuneiform form that was the prototype of the alphabetic language. And so the Phoenician language, about 2000 BC, began to develop an alphabet for the first time. In 1,000 years, in the millennium, that written Phoenician paired into the beginnings of classical Greek and classical Hebrew, about 1000 BC, which enabled David to write down his Psalms and enabled Homer to write his epics. We live at a time where 3,000 years later, we have learned to digitize language. But we have not yet appreciated that the zeros are as important as the ones. And that when those two are brought together, now a moment of thought is not a mental dot where the collection of the dots in the lithography will give you a picture, but it's only a picture. It's a mental fragment, actually, resolvable into dots. When you bring the zeros and the ones together, you get the moment of thought, the cheetah, where you recognize that the trill, the non-discursiveness, is, to use the old Coke ad, the pause that refreshes. You learn that a poetic takes its time to speak the poetic of the language so that it's not that you learn to remember, it's you learn remembering. And in this way, cognition is dwarfed by recognition. And recognition is spontaneous. In fact, one can recognize without looking, without hearing. You can get to where you turn to meet to see, or you turn to meet to hear, or you turn to meet to hug, before there was any cue on that. But it takes transforming the seasons into phases and then transforming the phases into dimensions. And as that happens, there's no longer an education which is testable, no longer a testability which is degreed, no longer a degree which gets you a job. You graduate out of that free. More next week.